Hi, everybody. Today is Tuesday, March 11th, 2025, and our friend Tony Norfield is back with us. Welcome back, Tony.
Thank you.
Let's get started, Tony, with the Trump administration and the way that they try to deal with Ukraine. Trump has halted military and intelligence aid to Ukraine. On the other hand, we see that the British government is trying to provide Ukrainians with, I don't know, with weapons, or of course we know that they're talking about providing Ukrainians with intelligence, at least. When you see right now, Zelensky's team is talking with the American team in Saudi Arabia. It seems that the first round of negotiation talks were positive, as we've learned right now. How do you see the way that Europe is distancing itself from the United States foreign policy in Ukraine?
A couple of things. I've got a slightly different angle on some of the things you just said. You hear really quite conflicting reports about how far the US has stopped intelligence reports. They might have done to some extent. It looks like they maybe have for attacks inside Russia. But of course, we had overnight several hundred drones from Ukraine going into Russia all the way to Moscow. So there's some intelligence getting there. It could be that either the Americans are not delivering it directly to Ukraine, but they're giving it to, say, France and the UK, who are then passing it on. To some extent, that sort of thing is likely to happen. Or it could be the Americans are just lying. And it turns out anyway that the Starlink Elon Musk system is still working, basically. So it's far less of a close down than it looks like. And as it stands now, although on the face of it, quite a lot of aid for Ukraine has been dropped, there's still, in any case, quite a lot of weaponry that Ukraine has that they can still use up. And the Europeans, of course, are shifting to try and be in a position to deliver even more weapons. And that is something which the Europeans have really stepped up on in the past week. You know, it seemed to be led by von der Leyen, really, coming out with this really astonishing plan for 800 billion euros of extra spending, admittedly over several years. And that was made up of about 650 billion euros of budget room, as you put it, by getting around the normal budget constraints that there are, you know, like 3% limits on deficits, this kind of thing, which many countries are above anyway. And basically saying, well, or in practice, more or less, you can spend what you like as long as it's on defense. Now, von der Leyen is only a civil servant, although she comes across as the Empress Queen of Europe, basically. So it has to go through the European political leaders and their parliaments in order to get passed. But Germany seems to have gone for it. And they immediately had a rise in their bond yields in the wake of that, you know, as the market is freaking out a bit about far more government spending. The UK's done the same. It's outside the European Union, doesn't necessarily take any notice of what von der Leyen says, but is similarly promising quite a big boost to military spending. And the explicit aim of this is to provide Ukraine with weaponry for an indefinite period of time. The other aspect, which there are, you know, the details are pretty limited at the moment, but the British and the French have invented this reincarnation of the American Coalition of the Willing. You know, that was the term they invented back in invading Iraq in 2003, I think, for ignoring the UN and going ahead with whoever would be on their side. And that was basically a number of NATO countries, but in particular the British, but mainly led by the Americans. This coalition of the willing is essentially dreamed up in response to the new Trump administration and is basically saying, well, look, we Europeans have to do something because the Americans seem to be pulling out. And it's quite true, the Americans want to pull out, but they want to load the burden of Ukraine onto the Europeans. And the big political issue for the Europeans is that they realize that if they screw up on this, and they will screw up, their status in the world economy is going to be greatly diminished. Already, the Americans pay them no attention. They've not been involved in these Ukraine negotiations, neither the British nor the EU. And whereas before they could rely upon being the reliable second in command, so to speak, for American hegemony in the world economy, now they can't rely upon that. And they're stuck with a more kind of MAGA-led US at the same time as you get and worried about competition from China. So we have a situation where the Europeans are frankly desperate. They may hope that, you know, the Trump administration kind of the next 4 years goes quickly or something like that, but they know they're stuck, really. So they're panicking like hell. And one of the things they cannot allow to happen is the whole collapse in Ukraine, because that completely blows up NATO. And so they've now fallen back on a big military buildup in order to strengthen themselves. But even they recognize that they couldn't get anywhere near Russia's level of military capacity for at least another 4 years or so. But that's what the underlying plan is for all these huge, huge spending things.
Do you see the role of the United Kingdom bolder than France or Germany, or they're all the same?
The Germans have played much more of a backseat, but that may change under Merz. It was a bit iffy or not going that far under Scholz before, and under Merkel before that, even though they played this role in sabotaging the Minsk agreements. Under Merz, he seems to be far more proactive in terms of building up the military, which ordinarily would freak out the other Europeans. but they've got the big Russian evil monster, so they think, next door. So they're going along with it. Then you got the French and the British. The French are really pissed off with the Russians because they're getting kicked out of Africa. And recently from Senegal, and previously, you know, Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger. So they're really annoyed about a diminution of their power anyway. And if the European center of power is greatly weakened by losing in Ukraine, that then just really freaks them out. They'll be looked upon as a second, third tier, fourth tier country. Similar kind of political calculation for the UK. It gets a bit ludicrous, actually. And last week's Economist magazine, a weekly transatlantic Anglo-hegemony rag, basically, that's what it is. They had on their UK cover a picture of, it was a kind of cartoon image of Churchill, but, you know, the face of Keir Starmer. And they called him, I think it was either, you know, Keir Churchill or Churchill Starmer or something like that, you know, completely ludicrous. And you can tell that really they couldn't have believed it either, because their covers for Europe and their covers for America and Asia were different. They wouldn't be able to sell that garbage in outside of the UK. And I don't think many people in the UK would believe it either. But the comments from Starmer, you know, this effort to try with political rhetoric to gain some political status in Europe. So the British often wanted to be the go-between for the Americans between continent of Europe and the US. So they could do that, have an extra status, special relationship, this kind of stuff, right? So with the Americans under the Trump administration not giving much attention to Europe anyway, they're even less inclined to bother much about the Brits. So the Brits are in a real panic over this, and how can we emphasize our political status? So this is where all this comes from. But of course, it's extremely dangerous, arguably even more dangerous than the French, who are now talking about extending their nuclear umbrella to other European countries. And the Polish are really into this now. They're open to that. And they also want to greatly build up their armed forces. So that among the political leadership in Europe, quite a lot of them are either neutral but don't say much, or are very much in favor of it. So you've got essentially the British, the French, the Polish, the three Baltic states, Estonia, Lithuania, Latvia, and a few others not knocking around. But hardly anybody, at least nobody in power, is really saying anything against this. Hungary is the main one, but I think even Slovakia, I'm not sure I got this right, but I think they went along with this rearmament thing, whereas Hungary was against it. So, yeah, well, when you look at the political leadership as it stands now, there's nothing really to stop it. And the oppositional groups either get sidelined before they get anywhere, as in Romania, or they're not quite strong enough, as with the forces in France and Germany and other places. So unfortunately, there's no easy way to stop this, because the Europeans are really all tied into it politically. And I think what it comes down to is it's got to be a more decisive move by Russia to make clear to them that they've lost in Ukraine. I think that will happen, but it's been a very slow process, and not much sign that it's really speeded up in the past month or so.
It seems that in the mind of European leaders, the situation, the case of the relationship between European countries and the United States is becoming a very challenging issue for them, because right now when they see they're in the worst position, in the worst situation that they have been since many years with the conflict in Ukraine. Right now, the United States is talking about they want to find their way of dealing with Russia and China. Mm-hmm. It doesn't seem that they do consider that they do take into account the case of European countries. It seems to me that in what makes Europe so much surprised and angry with the United States is that they're not taking them into account. they don't care what would be the future of the relationship between the United States and Europe. Much worse for the United Kingdom, because they have separated themselves from European Union. They thought that they're going to make new ties with the United States. They're going to be a very, some sort of coalition. I don't know how we can call it, some sort of friendship, partnership, beyond friendship, beyond anything else, that could make huge differences when it comes to the relationship between these two countries, comparing to that one with the European Union. It's much more complicated than what we are talking about and what we are witnessing in the talks that they're giving us.
Yeah. And the essentially, there is a real shakeup of the global system overall. And you get, of course, in a transition period, and it's, well, firstly, transition to what is it's unclear, because everyone recognizes rising power of, say, the BRICS countries, or, you know, in particular China, of course, but, you know, an alliance of more productive economic cooperative relationship between a whole bunch of countries outside of the more hegemonic predatory Western system. So that alone is a big worry for them and a bit of a shock, that before they could more or less say, do this, do that, or you get no IMF loans, no World Bank aid, none of this, none of that, sanctions from the US, all the rest of it. And have now found that, you know, Russia has survived sanctions and is doing economically much better than the Europeans. Even Iran has survived sanctions. North Korea has survived sanctions. So all of the standard political pressures that they would adopt don't really work anymore. And all of this is bringing forward the bigger prospect, I must say, of military confrontation. At the moment, it's just rhetoric and shouting. But, you know, there are many military exercises going on all over the place, you know, in the Arctic region, in the Baltic Sea, in different parts of Asia. And it's something where actually it's a bit unclear with the US. My underlying view is that they want to just dump the European Ukraine project and concentrate on China. That seems to be pretty much the common denominator of all the Trump administration statements. But they can't really just let NATO collapse. That would look a bit embarrassing. So you're getting instead, Trump will come along and say, you're not spending enough. It's your own fault. You've let, you know, you've made us do all your defense. It's down to you to do it. So he is in the blaming mode, for blaming them for everything. So he can then say, if you mess up, that it's your fault. It's nothing to do with me. In the same way that he pretends that he had nothing to do with Ukraine. Admittedly, he didn't do a great deal. But he, you know, he did sanctions on Russia. He continued all that stuff that the Obama administration had done before. But he's off the hook for the past 4 years of things developing. So I think the essential logic is that they want to focus more on China, and they hope that the Europeans can handle what's left of Ukraine. And they don't care that much anymore, because they can slowly pull out of it and politically cover themselves by blaming the Europeans or blaming Zelensky. And that's pretty much what they've done now. So you've had Rubio and Trump coming up with points that are obvious to everyone, that all of this started long before February 2022. So, yeah, that's the US doing the big shift. It then means that all the acolytes, or all the people who thought they had the big bad bully leading the gang, now find that the big bad bully, you know, doesn't really want to deal with them anymore, or just is using them and will put tariffs on their goods and all this kind of thing. So, they're completely in a mess because the Europeans haven't got a great deal to offer. In military terms, they've got a bunch of individual companies, you know, in Germany, in Sweden, France to an extent, UK to an extent, with different angles on military equipment that they can supply. But none of them on a big scale. All of their armies are pretty puny. So in terms of Europe kind of facing off against Russia in any actual war, forget it, basically. So that's why they've got this plan for the next 5 years or so. Hope, you know, they want to build it up. And the talk about, say, having peacekeeping forces in Ukraine, that's something which the Americans would probably propose as well. Because, again, it would be Europeans going in, not Americans. But it would not be accepted by the Russians. And also the Europeans somehow think that some Article 5 interpretation would mean that if Russia attacked, say, British or French forces in Ukraine, that NATO would come to their aid. But even that Article 5 has got ambiguities in it as to how far the rest of NATO is obliged to intervene. You know, they do what they see as appropriate. That's basically what it says. So, yeah, there are many things up in the air as a lot of the structure of the previous world is shaken up. And, you know, many different aspects are coming together now. One of the big focuses is obviously on Ukraine, because hopefully that's closer to an ending. But, you know, the whole other areas of world economy and politics as well.
If I were to see the new Soviet Union in the current situation that we're in, I would point out that Europe is the Soviet Union of the time that we're living in. Europe is not doing well economically, but they're trying to overstretch themselves, but these new project of increasing their defense budget and all of that. Mm-hmm. They wanted to inflict that on Russia. Right now, they're experiencing what they wanted to do with Russia. And do you think that in a long run, does the United States care about what, because the way that Europe is confronting the Trump administration, and they're not getting along with them, they're not finding a solution for a better end, for a better future for them, for European countries, I'm not talking about the United States. They're putting themselves in a very bad position. As you've mentioned, the focus of the United States is China. If European Union experienced a sudden collapse, which means that the countries are getting involved with their domestic policy, with their domestic problem, that they don't care about this connection among the countries. That would, I don't know how the United States can manage that if they want to focus on Russia and China and the new relationship, the new sort of policies toward them.
Yeah. Yeah, there certainly won't be a Marshall Plan for 2026. save the Europeans. In many ways you find on the US side that there is much more of a pulling back to the home base, you know, which is where we mentioned before, you know, you've got Greenland and Panama coming into it, you know. The US would be worried about Europe from the point of view of it being a market that they sell into, and but basically, the Europeans, I think, are getting more and more annoyed at having to pay over the odds for energy, you know, liquefied natural gas and all this kind of stuff, whereas they previously used to have the cheap Russian energy. I don't really see any way out for Europe, actually. All of the countries have got pretty low growth, pretty low productivity, rising social problems, rising unemployment, big deficits on their spending, all kinds of things are going wrong. And they're not, you know, I'm exaggerating a little, but if you thought of Europe, what is it kind of offering to the world, you know, in terms of, can you think of any new inventions or something like this? You come up with a blank, basically. All the big tech stuff is either done by the US or by China. And, you know, the Europeans are kind of nowhere. I mean, I'm sure there's something knocking around somewhere, but I can't think off the top of my head of a single thing where that you say, okay, this is some European development. This is what they can offer. And it's a fairly pitiable decline, actually. And the more they have people like von der Leyen and Starmer and Macron burbling on, the more it's going to continue like that. And I don't think anyone's really going to pity them. You know, they'll say, your fault, you know, get on with it. But it's something that in the end will lead to political changes. And I think I mentioned in our previous discussions, the whole problem is that the political changes now are being led by, you know, right-wing, very conservative kind of reactionary forces. And, you know, they're giving, if you like, the voice of the popular masses, because ordinary people are pretty annoyed about all of these developments. And, you know, they're getting no response from the leadership that, you know, they've elected.
I think much of what's going on between the United States and Europe could be a function of what's going on between Europe and China. What does Europe mean to China, in your opinion? What is the importance of Europe for China, and how Europe can improve its position in dealing with China, which could influence the relationship between Europe and the United States?
There seems actually in the past couple of weeks to have been a bit of a more positive change of European political views towards China. Previously, it was, you know, unfair competition, you're undercutting us, we'll put tariffs on electric vehicles, kick out Huawei's telecom equipment and phones, all this kind of stuff. So it's fairly hostile, pretty much following all the US stuff. But there have been some recent indications that more of a discussion is going on. Not much, actually, just yet. But I think that the Europeans would be silly to greatly oppose China, which they largely got into because of US policy, and still keep that policy while the US is screwing Europe. So that would be a dumb policy. But the problem they face is that they're uncompetitive in a wide range of industries. And, you know, you get German auto manufacturers having a much better time with their operations in China and doing, you know, seeing China as a big center for technical development with, you know, more modern electric vehicles, hybrid vehicles, this kind of thing. So, yeah, they've got a real problem of how to rebuild some relationships that they've blown up and still, you know, get something going. And I think they're going to have to greatly reduce their arrogance and feeling of self-importance in order to be able to do that. But that I think is going to be a long process. And, you know, I'd be fairly depressed about the outlook for Europe, actually.
Do they really want a future with Russia, or they're just with what they're doing and what we've seen so far from them, they're not considering a substantial relationship between European countries and Russia?
Yeah, there's been...
When I'm talking about they, I'm not talking about all of European countries. I'm talking about especially the Western European countries, the United Kingdom, France, and Germany.
Yeah. I think there's only really been some sign of cracks in Germany, and that's due to, you know, the Sarah Wagenknecht group and also the Alternative for Germany. You know, talking about reopening the Nord Stream pipeline. And that would be backed up by quite a lot of German business. But the dominating political view is, you know, we should go nowhere near Russian energy, for example. And, you know, that's from an EU perspective, that's more or less written in stone by the European Commission and in all these rules. The UK, I can't see them really changing that much, or even if they did, why the Russians would believe them anyway. You know, and just the other week they kicked out a couple of diplomats from the Moscow embassy for spying. So, you know, there is a great deal of anger in Russia about the kind of background sabotaging underhand role that the British have played in Ukraine. And that would greatly sour relations, even if the British wanted to build them up again. But the British have had, you know, for well over 100 years, anti-Russian standpoints, you know, initially under the Russian Empire and the Tsar, and then under the Bolsheviks, and then under anyone else, basically. So they've always been angered at the power that Russia potentially holds, given, you know, the huge landmass that it has on the European continent. So I can't really see any recovery in British-Russian relations. And almost because of the European Commission, I can't see much happening on the EU side either. Even though there are individual countries that would be happy to have that happen, you know, I think, say, Slovakia, Hungary, and bits of Germany.
What's so interesting and concerning that is Macron is talking about building new nuclear bombs for Europe and for the future of Europe, while we know that at least right now in the United States, Donald Trump is talking about denuclearization and the new talks, the new treaties. I don't know if he's serious about that, but he's talking about it at least.
Yeah.
And Russia showed with the Oreshnik, the new sort of missiles that they have, hypersonic missiles, the new generation of hypersonic, that they don't need nuclear bombs to be used in any sort of conventional war.
Yeah, yeah.
Why does Europe needs to go nuclear if nobody is going to be interested in nuclear bombs? And by the way, they want to reduce nuclear bombs, at least from what we've seen so far. Why they're not, what they're not finding, they're not seeking for some other solutions for them, for their problems?
Again, I think it's desperation. And the French come out of this because they're the only so-called independent nuclear power in Europe. You know, the UK stuff is largely American-dominated anyway. You know, they're American, British-American so-called nuclear weapons in Britain. France has more of an independent nuclear capability. So it gives it a card to play to raise its status with European defense. So I think that's the basic logic. And the issue these days is how fast can you deliver this stuff? And if you don't have hypersonic missiles, and the US hasn't really got them, or none that have really been proved to work yet. Russia's used them a number of times, and the Oreshnik, as you say, it's not even nuclear, but when something comes at you at Mach 14, you know, and it's got a big warhead, then you're going to get a pretty serious explosion.
My question, Tony, is that acceptable for the United States to let France or European countries go after new nuclear bombs and build in nuclear bombs? I don't see that coming from the United States.
No, I agree that there wouldn't be the French proposal. I really don't think would be an American driven proposal. It's more definitely a French proposal to raise their status. And the Americans wanted a nuclear deal between Russia and the US. But also, as part of that, they wanted to include China, which has been outside of these traditional nuclear deals. And the whole problem with all this is that the US has broken many of these in the past and, you know, placed nuclear capable fighter jets as well as missiles in a whole bunch of European countries. So, you know, would the Russians believe them anyway when they keep doing this? And they might agree to something one year, then another president comes in and they do something different. So nuclear weapons are not going away. Nobody, I think, apart from the French now, want to develop them any further. And I don't think the Russians do either. And coming up with something like a Oreshnik, there wouldn't really be that much need to do that, you know. Everyone knows that, you know, you can put off your, blow up your nuclear bomb and you kill the enemy, but then you pollute a huge area for, you know, hundreds of years, probably, you know, thousands of years, who knows, you know. So the nuclear option for weapons, I think it's always going to be there as a backstop. And Iran needs it. Otherwise, you know, they're pretty sure that sooner or later the Americans would probably attack Iran. So one way of getting them to stop would be to have a delivery system that could also attack America with nuclear weapons. And, you know, the North Koreans think the same. And it's a common view, actually, that, you know, the nukes are the big deal. But with new weapons being developed, I think that in a way they're more dangerous, because it can then mean that you can use something like an Oreshnik and then you can claim you're not starting a nuclear war or anything. And also you're not kind of, you know, polluting the whole country. You're just completely blowing it to smithereens. But this again is one indication of how so many of the previous calculations are all now thrown up in the air. You know, there isn't a balance of forces and a kind of an implicit understanding. I think when the Russians launched the Oreshnik, they told the Americans what they were doing and when and where, more or less, it was going. Partly also to see that they couldn't do anything about it. You know, so Patriot systems or whatever in Ukraine couldn't stop an Oreshnik landing where they wanted it to land. But all of these previous ideas about military capacity are all being changed, and a lot of them being changed due to the Ukraine war. You know, the same goes for tanks and ships and everything else. You know, you can get 5,000 drones to attack an aircraft carrier, you know. So why do you need an aircraft carrier? And, you know, why do you need a $20 million tank that a couple of, you know, $1,000 drones can knock out? So all of these military calculations are now completely up in the air.
Yeah, by the way, with this case of new treaties, as we know, we have the experience of ABM and INF treaties with the Bush administration and the Trump administration. Both of them, the United States has decided to withdraw from the treaties. But mm-hmm. with the case of China, it seems that much more difficult because they don't have the quantity of bombs that the United States and Russia possess. That would make it even somehow impossible to bring them in, and how they're going to manage that, because right now the United States and Russia they have a lot of nuclear bombs that Russia doesn't possess at this particular moment.
It's always been, because China has always been on the outside of these bilateral deals between Russia and America. They seem to have fewer nuclear weapons, although, you know, I haven't counted them, so I can't really confirm that. They could easily produce a whole lot more if they wanted to. So, you know, maybe some kind of deal they could do to limit the increase or something like this. But it's going to be hard for the Americans if they're so aggressive towards China and have military bases all the way around the outside of China to talk to China about how they need to reduce their nuclear weapons. You know, forget it. It's one of these elements of instability that will probably get worse, basically. And, you know, we should just recognize, though, that it isn't China that's been invading people, you know, every year or so for the last 50 years, you know, 50, 75 years. Yeah.
Let's see what would happen. I think the new architecture of the that China, Russia, and the United States are trying to picture for us is so much important. And as you mentioned, the way that the United States is behaving in Taiwan, in close to China, and right now in Ukraine, it's much more decisive in any sort of agreement that they can achieve in the future. Yeah. Let's see what would happen. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Tony, for being with us today. Great pleasure to talk to you, as always.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Take care, Tony.
Bye.